My Classic Album with Mike Norris is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of My Classic Album and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.
Hi everyone, welcome to My Classic Album, the show that looks back on some of the greatest albums in music history. I'm Mike Norris, and thanks very much to everyone who tuned in to our previous episode, which was dedicated to Born to Run by Bruce Springsteen, as chosen by my guest Will Black. It was a really fun episode, I really enjoyed it. It was great to be able to play some music, which I'm hoping to do in future episodes of the podcast too. As for today, I'm very excited for you all to hear my chat with Tim King, one of the founding members of metal group Soil. And he has chosen Motley Crue's Shout with the Devil as his classic album today. And in a strange kind of parallel, you'll hear in the interview that Tim talks about how Shout with the Devil was an important album in his youth. And I would say the same for me personally, for Soil's second album, Scars. It was their breakthrough album. It came out in 2001, and obviously Halo was the big single from it. But there was tracks like Breaking Me Down, My Own, Unreal. And that album was a really important part of my teenage years. And I've been lucky enough to see them live a few times over the years. And they're just a great band. And so I often just fire these emails off to bands thinking, like, I'll probably not hear anything. So when I got the message back from Tim saying he was interested in taking part, I thought, this is going to be a great episode. And Shout with the Devil is an awesome album. And I think that interest in Motley Crue is at an all-time high. Love for Motley Crue is at an all-time high because of the release of the movie adaptation of the book The Dirt, which has just come out on Netflix. And I'm sure that you all have your thoughts on that. Some of you probably loved the film, some of you hated it. I know a lot of people are talking about Machine Gun Kelly playing Tommy Lee. Some people think he nailed it. Some people think he totally sucked. But the point is that everyone is talking about Motley Crue at the minute. And it's funny, like, they're one of those bands that in all walks of life, I often meet someone who, and it's not as if they come up to me and go, I love Motley Crue, but at some point it comes through that they're a Motley Crue fan. And they just seem to have permeated popular culture, maybe a lot more than people give them credit for. And me and Tim talk about this a little bit, that Nikki Sixx and Tommy Lee particularly are just huge pop culture icons, even beyond Motley Crue and the albums and the songs that they created. So Shout with the Devil is a really interesting album. It's a great album, but it's a really good one to unpick because there's so much going on for the band at the time. Similar to Scars for Soil, Shout with the Devil was their big breakthrough album, and it set them on the road to a phenomenal career and a phenomenal story that we've seen brought to life in the Netflix movie, The Dirt. So if you've seen the movie and you're kind of interested to know a bit more about what's going on with Motley Crue, Tim and I are going to be breaking down the album very soon. And of course, as always, we'll be going through the whole album track by track. But before we do that, I just want to let you guys know about a few episodes we've got coming up over the next few weeks. So from a huge change of pace from Motley Crue, we're going to be looking at Aretha Franklin's I Never Loved a Man the Way That I Love You. On our next episode of My Classic Album, my special guest is Nell Bryden, who is a phenomenal singer-songwriter that I was so excited agreed to come on the show. And she's just got this really deep love for Aretha Franklin, which is just so infectious. And the album is fantastic. And it is one of those, it's, we're talking about breakthrough albums, it's Aretha's breakthrough album. So we're doing a lot of breakthrough albums at the moment. And it's just a great, great collection of songs. And me and Nell had a really fab chat about it. So that's coming up on the 1st of May. And then on the 15th of May, we're going to be doing our first ever soundtrack on My Classic Album. So when I started the podcast, I didn't necessarily think we'd ever touch on a soundtrack, but this is one that is not only awesome and got great songs, which is the most important thing, but it is actually really important in music history and the history of glam rock and maybe even punk to an extent. And that album is the soundtrack to the Rocky Horror Picture Show. So the 1975 movie with Tim Curry, Richard O'Brien, Meatloaf. So of course I was going to go for it. Savannah Pope, American rock artist, has chosen that. And yeah, I cannot wait for you to hear that, because I had so much fun recording that episode. And it was a little different because obviously we're talking about the soundtrack, but inevitably we're talking about the movie too. So it was a different beast. It was a bit different. I tried to tackle it in the same way I would any other album, but I think the results came out really well. So I hope you enjoy that. That's coming up on the 15th of May, so only a few short weeks from now. But today, it's all about Motley Crue and their breakthrough album, Shout with the Devil. My special guest who chose the album, Tim King, will be along very soon. But before we get to Tim, let's have a look at the facts. Here's what you need to know about Shout with the Devil. American heavy metal band Motley Crue released their second studio album, Shout with the Devil, on September the 26th, 1983. The album was the major label debut of the band, who upon releasing their previous album, Too Fast for Love, on their own label, Leather Records, caught the attention of Elektra, who promptly signed them. Elektra sent Motley Crue to work on what would become Shout with the Devil at Cherokee Studios in Hollywood, California, with producer Tom Werman. Tom got the band up to speed on how to work in a studio environment as they worked on the album through the early part of 1983. Title track Shout at the Devil was the lead single from the album. In spite of hysteria and accusations of Satanism directed at the band, Shout at the Devil reached number 30 on the US mainstream rock chart. January 1984 saw the release of Looks That Kill. Accompanied by a memorable music video for MTV, the single peaked at number 54 on the Billboard Hot 100. A few months later, in April 1984, the final single from the album, Too Young to Fall in Love, reached number 90 in the United States. On the album's release, signing Motley Crue revealed itself to be a shrewd move by Elektra. In spite of, or perhaps even because of, the controversy surrounding the album, Shout at the Devil reached number 17 on the Billboard 200, and the following year would chart at number 23 in Canada's RPM 100 albums chart. By 1997, the album was certified 4x platinum in the United States. While the album was less successful in the UK, Motley Crue were on their way to metal immortality. Initial critical opinion of the album was largely negative, but over time Shout with the Devil has been recognised as an important milestone in heavy metal and a stepping stone to Motley Crue's involvement in the burgeoning glam metal scene. Rolling Stone, who were critical of the album as recently as 2004, ranked it 44th in its 100 Greatest Metal Albums of All Time in 2017, while NME called it the quintessential 80s metal album when it named it amongst its 100 Greatest Heavy Metal Albums in 2009. So that's just the beginning of what we need to know about Shout with the Devil, and I have here with me my very special guest today who chose the album from Soil. This is Tim King. How's it going?
Hey man, how you doing?
Yeah, I'm great, thanks. Thanks so much for picking Shout with the Devil. It's a really great album and it's one that there's a lot to get into. Why have you chosen Shout with the Devil to talk about on my classic album today?
It's basically the first album that really got me into heavy metal and heavy music, and perpetuated me into, you know, discovering other artists and getting into that lifestyle and everything. And it still remains to this day my favorite record of all time. And when I first heard it for the first time ever, it's kind of a funny story. I was on the playground and I was in sixth grade, and there was a group of four of us. We were like four friends that always hung out, and my friend brought the Shout at the Devil cassette, and he's like, check out this new album that my brother just bought. It just came out. It's by this band, Motley Crue. And it had the four of them on the cover. And we're like, oh my gosh, wow, that's so cool. And this and that. And they look so awesome. And we would play the album in music class, because when we have music class every day, they let you play stuff on these little recorders and stuff. So we would play it and listen to it and, you know, read the liner notes. And we each picked out who we would be from the cover. You know, and my one friend took Vince Neil. I think I got stuck with Tommy Lee or something. And kind of our alien friend got to be Mick Mars and all this other stuff. But we just listened to it nonstop. And, you know, that was the record that got me into, you know, discovering who Ozzy Osbourne was, and Wasp and Judas Priest and all those bands that started, you know, becoming popular and launching heavy metal as we knew it back in the 80s.
So it seems to be that for the vast majority of people, Shout at the Devil is the definitive Motley Crue album. It's certainly my favorite album by the band, and I'm guessing because we're talking about it, it's yours as well. What is it about this one that makes it stand out amongst the rest of their albums? Albums like Girls, 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 Dr. Feelgood, albums that would come later on in their career.
I mean, naturally, I think you always have a soft spot in your heart when you discover a band and the first record that you hear from them that you really like and fall in love with. kind of always stays your favorite. But having said that, and after I've heard Shout at the Devil, I naturally went to see if there was any other stuff, and Too Fast for Love was out too, and I bought that one as well, and I love Too Fast for Love. It's just a monumental, groundbreaking record. But, you know, Shout at the Devil to me just had the whole package. They had the really cool look at the time. It was really dark and evil, kind of. The stage set that they were using was awesome. You know, the way they perpetuated their lifestyle and the way they talked and the way they did things, it just sort of has this whole entire, like, crazy experience from, if you listen to it from in the beginning to Danger, from front to back, and you just listen to that whole album, the continuity is perfect. The vibe and the feel of it is amazing. And I can always listen to that record and go back in time to, like, you know, think about simpler times. And, you know, I was just a kid then. So it was all about, you know, playing on the playground and listening to music and hanging out with your friends and riding bikes. And it wasn't about paying a mortgage payment or, you know, watching kids or having a job or doing anything like that. It just kind of gets me personally back into, you know, simpler times and awesome moments of being a kid. And, you know, I love all the other Motley Crue records too. I mean, I even love Generation Swine, who a lot of people kind of, like, you know, put under the, you know, I don't know about that one or whatever. And the Karabi record's awesome. And naturally, Dr. Feelgood's amazing and stuff like that. But Shout Devil just holds that special place in my heart.
So you've talked a little bit about Too Fast for Love. If we go back to the early 80s, that was their debut album that they released in November 1981. And it impressed Elektra Records enough to sign the band. And they re-released the album the following year. And it was remixed by Queen producer Roy Thomas Baker. Now, I know you've said you love the album. How do you think it differs to Shout with the Devil? What progression is there between the two albums?
I always think with somebody's, like, debut album, they're just kind of finding themselves as a band. And, you know, Too Fast for Love just had that raw kind of almost demo-y feel to it. And there's a lot of cross genres. You can hear some, you know, punk rock in there. You can hear some metal. You can hear some just, like, classic Aerosmith type stuff. But I really think they really honed their skills and really got to the definitive sound of Motley Crue with Shout at the Devil. It was such a progression between the two. It's like they definitely found out who they are as musicians, who they are as a band, and what they wanted to sound like at the time.
Classic Rock Review say of the album, Shout at the Devil is the point where Motley Crue's musical range widened and the perfect template for hair metal was forged for the coming years. And of course, by the mid-80s, as we all know by now, Motley Crue would be the kings of the strip. But I feel like you were talking a bit about how Too Fast for Love has kind of a lot of other genres coming in. I feel like Shout at the Devil has a lot more going on than just hair metal. I don't know if you've listened to the podcast before, but we had Blaze Bailey, and he chose Holy Diver as his classic album. That was released the same year as this, and I feel like that you could put those two albums together, Holy Diver and Shout at the Devil, and they perfectly explain what heavy metal was in 1983. Obviously, they would perfect that hair metal sound later on, but there's parts of this album that I feel like almost tip their hat to bands like Judas Priest or Iron Maiden, as well as their contemporaries like Quiet Riot or Dokken. Do we know much about what bands were influencing them at the time? I mean, I know that a lot of people talk about that Kiss were a huge influence for them early on.
Yeah, I mean, for like Nikki Sixx and stuff, he was really into like Mott the Hoople, and, you know, the band as a whole were really into like AC/DC and Aerosmith, things like that. They weren't really from just interviews I've read and, you know, everything that I've heard of Motley Crue over the years and stuff. I think they were more influenced by like the 70s sound rather than the current things going on with the 80s. So they were more pioneers, I think, of the heavy metal genre than they were followers. And I think that's what really defined them. And, you know, I don't even consider Motley Crue a hair band until the Theater of Pain era. You know, if you look at Too Fast for Love, they were almost like a rebellious punk meets rock, like Aerosmith and Cheap Trick type band, combining that with like the Sex Pistols. And then Shout at the Devil, they truly became, I think, a metal band, even though they always said, we're not a heavy metal band, we're just a rock band, you know, and they were very explicit about that back in the day. But I think they jumped in with just, you know, almost like the British wave of heavy metal, you know, like Judas Priest and Maiden and, you know, Wasp was coming up at the time and stuff like that. And I think when they switched to be more theatrical and a little bit more glammy on Theater of Pain, that's what really opened up the hair metal genre, where people just started, like, you know, grabbing onto what they were doing then. And then you saw a rise of, like, you know, Poison coming out and Cinderella and a lot of copycat type bands from that point on that kind of grabbed onto that. But I don't think the glam metal as a whole, even for Motley Crue, came about until Theater of Pain.
And I mean, the music on this album is really strong. And of course, we'll get to that in more detail once we go track by track. I want to talk up for a little bit about Tom Werman's production. So this was his first album with the band, and he would go on to produce Theater of Pain, that we've been talking about a little bit, and Girls, Girls, Girls. He'd previously worked with bands like Blue Oyster Cult, and he'd done Ted Nugent's debut album. Do you feel that the albums benefit from Tom's style of production, and do you think that those three stand out particularly against some of the other albums that they would do later in the career with Bob Rock and people like that?
I actually love Tom Werman. I think that he really brought out a lot in the band. What I like about him is he kept the rawness of, you know, not only Motley Crue, but the other bands he worked with, but he polished it to like a sound that you can still listen to those records today and they still sound powerful. They still sound good, but he didn't over polish the band and use too many bells, whistles, and tricks on things. And like, if you listen to like the Bob Rock albums that Motley Crue did, there's a lot of bells and whistles, a ton of layering, and they're fantastic records. Don't get me wrong, but I just kind of prefer the Tom Werman style where he really gets to the core of what the band's about and then adds, you know, the finishing touches to it to make it sound big, make it sound produced, and make it sound, you know, slick, but still without being too shiny, I guess, if that makes any sense. And I like with Shout at the Devil, I love how the guitar sound was, you know, really heavy and raunchy sounding, to where a lot of other bands at the time had really like thin sounding guitars, you know, like almost to the point of where they didn't have enough low end to it. But Shout at the Devil is just a perfect blend of just some just heavy, gritty, in your face, but with a nice large production. That's what I really enjoyed about that record.
And I mean, crucially, it was Tom who would actually guide the band with regards to how to work in a studio environment. I've got a quote from Loudwire here that explains that when Motley Crue entered Cherokee Studios to start working on Shout of the Devil, they initially had little idea what to do in a professional recording environment, and Tom guided them through the process, explaining that there was no need for everyone to record their parts at the same time, and that even after everyone was done recording, they could go back and edit over what they'd done and fix mistakes. So we can see from that that obviously Tom's establishing a sound, and it's a sound obviously that you're a big fan of, not only on Motley Crue albums, but any albums that he's worked on. But he's a very significant role here in kind of getting Motley Crue to where they need to be to become the band they would become.
Yeah, he absolutely cleaned them up enough to where, you know, they could get more focus on everything. And I've read interviews with Tom where he said it was some of the hardest records he ever made with his Motley Crue records because they were just so out of control. But he also is super proud of them because, you know, Nikki Sixx's songwriting, and, you know, Tommy Lee is just a fantastic drummer. Vince is such an original vocalist, and Mick Mars's guitar sounds and tones. I mean, they really did have a perfect storm of a band with that. And I really do like the way Tom approached it. In fact, another record that I really love is Kicks Blow My Fuse, which is something that he did. He basically put that band on the map with that album, too. I wish he was still producing records. I hear he runs like a bed and breakfast off in, I think, Connecticut or something now, but he's been out of it.
Yeah, so I mean, the timing of our chat and this album choice is perfect, really, as Netflix have recently premiered The Dirt, which is a movie adaptation of the autobiography of Motley Crue. So I guess the interest in Motley Crue is possibly at its highest for a long time. The film gives a very vivid picture of the sex, drugs, and rock and roll lifestyle that the band had, even at this point in their career. They were seen by many as a volatile proposition, and you were saying even there that kind of Tom really found producing those albums challenging because of kind of having to wrangle the band together. Do you think that's part of the appeal of Motley Crue, that they were so outrageous that at that point in the 80s, they were like the epitome of cool?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was 11 years old when Shout at the Devil came out, and they've been my favorite band ever since. So, I mean, I've been with the band for, you know, decades, and remain my favorite band from when I heard Shout at the Devil on the playground until we're, you know, doing this podcast right now. I even modeled a lot of the stuff I've done, you know, with Soil and In Soil and with my own band to like a Motley Crue kind of standpoint of like a business perspective, and, you know, how they're always, you know, staying creative and doing things, you know, that are cutting edge and thinking outside the box and stuff like that. And that's one thing about Motley Crue that I've always admired, is how they can change their logo on every record and change their look or even kind of their style, but they're still Motley Crue. And, you know, back then, I mean, there was nothing like that. I mean, yeah, you had Kiss, but Kiss, I never really, even to this day, I've never been a huge Kiss fan. I just, you know, I don't know why. I think they write great songs, and I think they, you know, were the pioneers of, you know, like putting on makeup and costumes and stuff. But it wasn't until, you know, I heard Motley Crue that it really hit me, and the look of them went hand in hand with the music. I just thought they looked so cool. They had outrageous outfits on, longer hair than these other bands, and, you know, some of the singers in other bands had short hair, which is like, oh, you know, they don't look cool with, you know, a crew cut singing, you know, like Accept or Judas Priest or something like that. But the dangerousness of it, and the fact that, you know, you were afraid that if your parents caught you listening to the song Bastard or God Bless the Children of the Beast or something, that they might take the album away from you, always had that kind of like little extra, you know, dangerous vibe to it too, to where you wanted to like it even more.
And I mean, talking about that kind of controversy a little bit, it was Nikki Sixx that wanted this album particularly to stand out, and Shout of the Devil is an album that revels in controversy. So I've got a quote here from Ghost Cult magazine. They said in an article last year that Shout of the Devil was intentionally a little more gritty compared to their debut. They upped the imagery and homage for Satan, and it worked. There are a lot of nods to evil and deviltry, and most of them are corny and not scary. What they did was scare the shit out of Middle America, which was great. The band immediately was much more notable now than just perverting the Lord's Prayer. Shout of the Devil was literally meant to scare moms and dads. Meanwhile, those same moms and dads who were terrified of the album had kids, like yourself at 11 years old, for whom that appeal was irresistible. Like you say, that risk that if your mom and dad came in and heard you listening to Bastard or something like that, that they'd take it away.
It's a funny story you say that is, I was playing Shout of the Devil, and the song Bastard was on, and my mom came into my room to ask me a question, and I like turned white as a ghost. And for that time, that music was so heavy that, you know, parents didn't really hear what the lyrics were. You know, by today's standards, I mean, you listen to that record, you could point out every single word they're saying and something like that, compared to, like, you know, death metal and black metal and metalcore and all that other sort of stuff. But, you know, back then that was heavy, and my mom like thought she was being funny and started like dancing along to Bastard, and it gets to the end when it's like, you're not gonna fuck with me, and she was just oblivious to the whole thing. And I think what she thought they were saying is Faster, F-A-S-T-E-R, instead of Bastard. But I was like, I almost pissed my pants. I was so nervous, because I'm like, oh my gosh, if I get caught like that and she tells my dad or something, they're gonna take this record away. But it was just like, it was too heavy for them, so they never really caught on.
I mean, as we said, Nikki particularly wanted to play up all these satanic references on the album. So if we start with the album's name and the title track, that garnered a lot of controversy. I've heard that Nikki allegedly wanted to call the album Shout With The Devil. Tom Zutow, who discovered the band, claims that Nikki was exploring Satanism at the time. Now, I mean, they're not the first band in heavy metal history to explore Satanism and the occult. You can go right back to Black Sabbath. What is it about heavy metal that kind of lends itself so well to such kind of dark and controversial subject matter?
You know, I've often wondered that myself. And, you know, a lot of these people, I think they just do it more for the shock value of it, just to be a little bit more outrageous. I mean, naturally, you have some people that really take it seriously and go overboard with it and really do believe in that sort of stuff. But I think, you know, if you look at like the occult and, you know, pentagrams and skulls and things like that, I think it's more that the image of it is kind of like, you know, dark and kind of like mysterious, and that lends like a cool factor to it. And I think a lot of the bands, you know, use that sort of stuff because it was not something widely available or something really happy and stuff. And, you know, heavy metal music was created to let out angst, you know, to let your aggression out, go into a mosh pit or bang your head, or to listen to some loud music to get rid of your frustrations and stuff like that. And it still is like that today. And I think you can't really put, you know, some nice bright cover with somebody smiling on it to speak about, you know, frustration and letting out your anger and stuff like that. So I think a lot of the bands dove into that more so just for the shock value. In fact, Nikki Sixx even admits that he was doing it more for the shock value, and he was reading like some occult books, and he like threw like a pen up in the air and it stuck in the ceiling, and some weird stuff was happening when he was like diving into the material on that. But I don't think there is any sort of thing to put it to where it was like, oh yeah, we're going to get people to go join a cult or, you know, worship the devil or anything like that by any means. And if you actually listen to interviews, what Shout the Devil's about, it's about shouting at authority. It's about shouting at the, you know, whoever's holding you back. The devil is whoever's holding you back, whoever's telling you you can't do what you want to do or live your dreams or accomplish something, that they're telling you to shout at that and go for your dreams and be the person you want to be, regardless of what anybody says. So I think that was the whole concept behind that, which got blown massively out of proportion by the PMRC and, you know, the evangelists and parents and things like that.
And it's interesting you talk about the PMRC. We'll get to them a bit later on, actually. I mean, the name of the album eventually changed to the one we know, Shout at the Devil. And Tom Zitnout highlights a particular incident which sounds similar to the one that you were talking about, when he witnessed a knife and fork lift off a table and stick in the ceiling. And he believes that this caused even Nicky to reconsider the album's name. And I've got a quote from Tom here. He says, "I looked at Nicky and freaked out. There is no more shout with the devil. If you keep shouting with the devil, you're going to get killed. I truly believe that Nicky had unknowingly tapped into something evil, something more dangerous than he could control, that was on the verge of seriously hurting him." Nicky must have realised the same thing, because he decided on his own to change the album title to Shout at the Devil. So I don't know if that's just whether that actually happened, or whether that's a story to kind of get the promotional gears behind the album, but it's that kind of thing that truly enhances the legend of this album and just kind of what was going on around it.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I remember reading that exact passage from the book, The Dirt. That was something that Tom was actually recalling. I think Nicky was dating Lita Ford at the time or something.
Yeah. I mean, the original album cover, you talked about the now iconic one of all four members of the band. The original album cover also caught controversy, as the band had opted for a pentagram, but you could only see it when you held the album at a 45-degree angle. So then it was replaced by the one that kind of we've been talking about. Again, it's all, you were talking about kind of the idea that it's all done for controversy or buzz or hype around the album, and it's all perfectly executed to the point where all of this is going around in your head before you've even pushed play.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that was kind of the mystery of it, because nobody had really taken it that far at that point.
Absolutely, yeah. So if we combine the ambition of the four members of the band, the production of Tom Werman, the songwriting prowess of Nicky Six, and then this decision to kind of court controversy and get buzz around the album became a huge hit, and it solidified Motley Crue as the glam metal band of the 80s. Only to be challenged towards the end of the decade by Guns N' Roses, and we're talking the tail end of that. For those who are new to the band, or weren't around at the time, maybe they've watched The Dirt and they're wanting to know a bit more, can you try and give us an idea of just how huge Motley Crue were off the back of this album?
I mean, like I said, I got turned on to it by the cassette, like, really shortly after it came out, and nobody had really heard of what Motley Crue was or anything like that, and I think I even heard the album before they did the tour with Ozzy, and I wanted to go see that show, but I was just too young. I mean, you know, being 11 years old or whatever like that, my parents are like, you're too young to go to a concert like that or something like that. So I didn't get to see the Shout the Devil tour, but you could really see like that back then, and kids today probably, you know, are like, boy, that's like dinosaur type stuff, but everything lived and breathed by magazines like Circus and Hit Parade or Cream magazine. And, you know, there are all these various like rock and metal magazines that were out, and, you know, they would only come out monthly. So, you know, every time, you know, and I was just, funny enough, I was just talking with my friend who was one of the four people that was in my little circle of friends when we were all got to pick which member of Motley Crue were going to be. Me and him were just hanging out last weekend. We were talking about that, about how when we'd look at magazines, you know, when the new ones would come out on the shelves, anything that just remotely had anything Motley Crue, we'd grab and snatch up so that we could learn anything we could about this band, because there's no internet back then. And, you know, very few people we knew were into that music. So we knew really nothing about them other than what, you know, these magazines like, you know, Circus and Hit Parader and stuff were talking about them. And once in a while you could, you know, get a, I forget what the UK magazine was that was out at the time, but you could get that on import, and sometimes they had them in there and stuff like that. You know, I watched it grow, and they just got bigger and bigger. And, you know, I got a Motley Crue t-shirt that I wore to school. You know, everybody was looking at me like, oh man, what is this? And then slowly, you know, all these other kids started wearing Motley Crue t-shirts to school, and just watched it just get bigger and bigger. But it wasn't quite until like the Dr. Feelgood era, when like the jocks and the like people that were listening to, you know, like Duran Duran and crap like that started like wearing like Motley Crue and Metallica shirts and stuff. And that's what really kind of pissed me off, because it was no longer, you were part of the exclusive club, but I mean, just, it was just everywhere, you know, especially like in 83, 84, when that Motley record was at its peak. I mean, people were listening, you'd see the t-shirts when you go to like, you know, out to dinner, or you go, you know, the park or somewhere. And it just was such a phenomenon. And you go into the record store and they just have the Motley Crue tapestries everywhere, and shirts and buttons and patches. It was an awesome time. And it was really cool to see like my favorite band at the time just getting bigger and bigger.
And just before we go track by track, I've got a quote from Vince Neil. He talked to Loudwire in 2010 about what felt like this sudden rise to fame when they appeared at the US Festival in May 1983, shortly before the album's release. He said, "We were just kids. Shout of the Devil hadn't come out yet. And all of a sudden, there were 300,000 people there screaming. It was like we went from playing clubs to doing something majorly big. We were on the same bill as Van Halen, Scorpions, Ozzy, and Judas Priest. That really blew us away." So once the album was released, there was definitely no going back for Motley Crue at that point.
Absolutely. I mean, it used to be really hard to get bootlegs of those, of that US Festival performance. And like, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, they finally got it to where you could, you know, people were passing around on like video cassette and stuff like that. But, you know, it's on YouTube naturally. And if you watch that, it's just mind blowing, that performance. That was the first time they came out in the Shout at the Devil gear. That was the first time they played those songs. And even though they didn't play very well, it's just, it didn't matter because they were just on fire as far as that imagery and the way they looked. And it was just so outrageous for the time. They looked so cool. And that's definitely, I think in all the Motley Crue stuff, they look so cool in that era. And as they self-proclaim it, they were watching Escape from New York and the Road Warrior. And that's how they came up with the entire concept for that whole stage show and the costumes and all that, is they want to make it a combo of those two movies, like a post-apocalyptic thing, which nobody was doing at the time. And I don't know, it's just still thinking about it. It's just so awesome. You know, if just to think back the way they looked back then, and then the blood sessions with Niels Lohsauer with the photos, and where they were just like had the blood all over Nikki's white BC Rich Warlock, and they're holding up, you know, bloody knives and all that. That was great.
Tim King there chatting with me about his chosen classic album, Shout of the Devil by Motley Crue. And we're going to get back to my chat with Tim very, very quickly indeed. But before we do, I'd love to know your thoughts on the album, on my chat with Tim, on anything related to My Classic Album. Get yourself on the social media pages. You can find us on Facebook, search for My Classic Album with Mike Norris. Follow us on Instagram at My Classic Album Podcast, or you can follow us on Twitter at MCA_podcast. Coming up, which of the songs on the album has the distinction of being part of the Filthy 15? And did Nikki Sixx even play on the album at all? All that and more right after this. Enjoying this episode of My Classic Album? Don't forget there are loads of amazing albums covered in our previous episodes as part of Season 1, with guests including Guns N' Roses keyboardist Dizzy Reed.
If I had to pick one like favorite band, or I guess a band that was the biggest influence on me, I would go with the Rolling Stones.
Blues guitarist Big Boy Blotter.
It sounded great then and it sounded great now. It just seems to have stood the test of time with me anyway, so yeah, it's a real classic for me.
And Nathan Stevens Griffin of Martha.
It's a great song musically, you're absolutely right. It's a banger. Mm-hmm. It is like absolutely a barnstormer of an album opener right there.
Also, there's our anniversary episodes, such as 40 Years of Rumours with Fleetwood Mac, including an interview with engineer Ken Kelly.
Within about 15 minutes, the band was fighting. I've seen, you know, Crosby, Stills and Nash fight. I've seen Kenny Loggins and Jim Messina fight, but this was a weird, I've never seen couples fight.
And 40 Years of Bat Out of Hell, including an interview with the voice of Paradise by the Dashboard Light, Ellen Foley.
Time is sometimes tricky. Sometimes things seem like very long ago in another life, which it is, but it all, the memories of it and certainly the song itself is always sort of alive in my mind.
All these episodes and more are available at www.myclassicalbum.co.uk and on Podnos, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. So we'll get into track by track. We'll get started with the first track, which is In the Beginning. So our first track is actually an introduction to the album rather than a song in its own right. So it's a monologue written by Nikki Sixx and credited to a character that he created called Alistair Fiend. And in it, the world has been overthrown by evil, and Alistair proclaims that the time has come to shout at the devil. So how does In the Beginning set the tone for the album and help it stand out against other albums that were around at the time?
I mean, absolutely the most perfect intro to an album of all time, in my opinion. I mean, it just sets the tone for the continuity of the record and how the whole record is going to go. It's almost like being introduced to a horror film on tape, you know, without the visual. And still to this day, if anybody tells me that Motley Crue is their favorite band, immediately I'm like, you have to be able to say on the spot the entire intro to In the Beginning. And if they get it wrong, then they're not truly a Motley Crue fan, in my opinion. In fact, real quick story before we go on. Soil played Australia at the Soundwave Festival in 2014. And they have buses that take the bands back and forth from the festival grounds to the hotel rooms. And we're all on a bus with like a ton of other bands. you know, like El Nino is on there, Bowling for Soup. I think Skindred. I mean, just a ton of bands are all on there. And somebody was like saying, you know, who can recite Into the Beginning from Motley Crue? And our singer Ryan, you know, taps me on the shoulder. He's like, this guy right here, this guy right here. And I nailed it word for word and had the whole bus like chanting along with me on there. So, you know, I inducted them all into the Motley Crue fan club right there. So we're all right. But yeah, just perfect intro to a record. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, Alistair was actually voiced by engineer Jeff Workman, who also composed the music on the track. And what I love is how much this introduction shows the thought that the band, but Nicky in particular, is putting into recording this album. So not only does he want a mood-setting introduction, but he creates a character around it in Alistair Fiend. And it just shows that at that point in Motley Crue's career, how invested he is and how invested they were in becoming a force to be reckoned with, which of course they would become in the future.
Absolutely. And it's just, you know, Nicky had that vision and he was the visionary of the band and was able to find three other people that, you know, shared that same vision and went for it, you know.
So we'll move on to our title track, Shout at the Devil, one of the most recognizable songs in Motley Crue's back catalogue. And obviously, well, when I'd written this, I'd said obviously one of the most controversial on the album. But as we get on, I think there's quite a few that maybe kind of lobby for that spot. Many believe that this is one of the best songs, not only on the album, but by Motley Crue, full stop. What are your thoughts on Shout at the Devil, the song? And is this the peak of the album, or are there songs later on that you enjoy more?
I definitely don't think it's the peak, but I think it's the perfect way to intro it with the bass slide, doom, doom. It just really drives you into that record. And, you know, definitely one of the greatest Motley songs for sure. In fact, I even had a engineer friend of mine kind of alter the song and everything and cut it down to about 30 seconds and played it at my wedding when me and my wife were walking down the aisle. So if that goes to show you how much I love Motley Crue and love the song Shout at the Devil, but just quite honestly, just kind of a perfect opening song to a record. I don't really know what more to say about it.
Speaking with Entertainment Weekly back in 2015, Nicky said of the song, "It's always been a song about pushing back. This is something you were talking about before. It could be about the perceived enemy at hand, the devil inside, or someone on a wobbly campaign trail. The lyrics, and particularly the sing-along chorus, they're almost a call to arms." And I think I know you were saying about kind of how it's about kind of shouting and pushing back at someone who's stopping you try to achieve your dreams or your ambitions, rather than it necessarily being this hugely satanic song.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I don't really even think of Motley Crue as a satanic band. Even when they were using all the pentagrams and everything, I didn't even think of it then, because they never ever said, you know, we believe in the devil, or we're, you know, we're doing this for the black overlord or anything like that. They just kind of use it as symbolism, you know. And I never, even back when that record came out, I never even thought of it as being anything devil related. I just thought of it as, you know, just dark and brooding imagery that went with the whole post-apocalyptic type theme, when, you know, the earth is destroyed or a nuclear war happened. It was almost more of like a post-apocalyptic nuclear war thing, because that's when, you know, the nuclear scare was going on. You know, everybody was afraid that the Russians were going to attack us all and stuff, you know. It kind of went with that whole theme of the apocalypse could be coming, which is more what I thought of it, rather than like anything satanic.
A quote from an interview with Loudwire that Vince Neil gave back in 2010. In the same interview, he said, "Some people said we were satanic and angry. We always thought that was funny. But we were like, hey, if it gets us attention, let's go with that. We were so starved for stardom that we were willing to do whatever it took. But there was no anger at all. We were just having fun." Which I think kind of sums up their attitude to the whole situation.
Oh, absolutely. I totally agree.
And I mean, in that same Entertainment Weekly interview I just referenced from Nicky there, they asked him if the controversy was intentional. And he simply answered, "Was it intentional? You'll never know." So regardless, it obviously worked. It obviously worked, as we're still talking about it over 30 years later. And a lot of that is not just because of the controversy, but because it's a great heavy metal song that stood the test of time. And that's why we're still talking about it today.
Absolutely.
Just before we move on to our next track, apparently, if you play the song backwards, Nicky Six and Tommy Lee supposedly chant "Jesus is Satan" during Shout at the Devil. Have you heard that? And if so, is it easy to spot, or is it one of those things where if you want to hear it, it's there?
I've never heard that personally. I mean, I've never, you know, heard the backwards message on it. And I know that in the liner notes of that record, they said, "Warning, this album may contain backwards messages." Again, I think it was just more of a shock value and something that they could just get people talking about and wondering about. And I don't know if they necessarily actually did that. They've never come out and admitted that they've that they've said that. So, I mean, people might just be hearing it in there. I personally don't think there is any backwards messages in it, but that's just me.
I mean, it's even like, if you turn, another one bites the dust backwards. It sounds like Freddie singing, "It's fun to smoke marijuana." So it's one of those things where it's like, if you want to hear it, it's there. But, you know, at the same time, I think there was so much of this going on in the 80s where people thought the heavy metal bands were leaving messages in songs. I mean, obviously, Ozzy had a lot of kind of trouble around that kind of thing as well. And I think Judas Priest might have as well around that time.
Yeah, there's a lot of problem in the United States with that. It was Suicide Solution, and they were saying that if you spun it backwards, it said, "Get the knife, kill, kill, kill." I mean, Ozzy's like, you know, no way would I say that and put it on a backwards message. So I think that was just a lot of kind of like hype and, you know, people just trying to shock and scare people into banning these bands or, you know, things like that.
So we'll move on to our next track. So after the firepower of Shout of the Devil, Looks That Kill keeps that momentum going. Ghost Cult magazine says of the track, "Looks That Kill has a sweet shout-along chorus, descending riff, killer solo, and that heavy beat." Do you agree with me that Looks That Kill was probably the more radio-friendly proposition at that point, bearing in mind, you know, the subject matter that people thought that Shout of the Devil might be about?
Yeah, it was. I mean, that's just an awesome song, and the video is even better. I remember seeing it, you know, late night on like cable access TV or something, and was just like, wow. The video, even to this day, is still jaw-dropping. It's just so perfectly done, and the stage setup for it and the look of the band. I mean, you can't get much better than that. And the song's just, it's, what's crazy is it's a pop song. If you really dissect that song, it's a pop song, but it's just surrounded by all the imagery and the heavy guitars and all that to where it, you know, they were able to blend heavy metal onto a pop song and make it, you know, become popular and stuff like that. It was great. I mean, just great songwriting.
So it's at this point that I want to single out Mick Mars. So in a band with huge pop culture names like Tommy Lee and Nikki Sixx, I think that Mick's often in danger of being a little overlooked. However, when he's playing guitar like this, like he is throughout the whole album, you ignore him at your peril because, as I said, throughout this album, I feel that Mick Mars is absolutely phenomenal.
Oh, yeah. He's such an underrated guitar player. It's sickening because he's so good. But the thing is he's such a quiet person and all he likes to do is play guitar. He doesn't care about, you know, what's going on in the world. He doesn't care about politics or any of the drama or anything. He just wants to play his guitar. You know, as evident that we all found out later on is he had that debilitating disease, you know, AS. And that was like the thing that just kept him down. So all he really cared about was being able to play. And I mean, I've heard so many bands cover Motley Crue songs over the years. And especially like the song Live Wire. So many bands have covered Live Wire, but nobody can get that riff. I've not heard one person play it the way Mick Mars plays it. And I've even seen Vince Neil solo with his backing band and his backing guitar player doesn't play the riff right. It's just like Mick Mars is the only one that can play that Live Wire riff like perfectly. It's just, and he's just such an amazing guitar player with the things that he does. And they're not like show offy things. They're just things that if you listen to, and you try to recreate him or try to play him, you're like, how does he do that? Because he's so original. It's crazy.
So, I mean, this song seems closer in tone to what we'd come to expect from the glam metal scene later on in the 80s. Ultimate Classic Rock claimed that Motley Crue were the first heavy metal band to truly cross over from the male to the female audience, which automatically doubled the band's fan base building prospects. Does a song like Looks That Kill play a big part in that? I mean, I'm sure the music video didn't hurt matters. And I know you were saying that obviously, in its essence, it is a pop song.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if the female audience really grabbed on to Motley Crue until like the ballad Home Sweet Home broke. But I think they just found the guys like really appealing, like dangerous and sexy. And that lured the girls into that. And I think they still hadn't tipped the scales to where they could appeal like a huge female audience, but they definitely had the look. And I think with some of the sound to where it wasn't as crazy as some of the other metal bands that were going on. Like we were saying, like more in the, like a pop song hidden with the heavy metal overtones and stuff. I think that did play a good role in it, but I think the girls mainly came because they saw the bad boys, you know, the dangerous bad boys that looked almost hotter than they did in some respects. And, they wanted to come out and see it, you know, for all it was worth.
So we'll move on to Bastard. So we've talked a little bit about Bastard already. Naturally, with all the controversy that the album was causing, when Tipper Gore, who's Al Gore's wife, waged a war on profanity in music, Motley Crue were one of the acts targeted by the PMRC that she founded. And we touched on them a little bit earlier, and it was this song, Bastard, that holds the distinction of being one of the infamous Filthy 15 compiled by the organization. What is it about Bastard? And obviously, we'll get into it lyrically as well. What is it about it that got the parents of America into a blind panic? What was it that made you panic so much when your mum walked into the room and you were playing that song?
I mean, it was just because it was a swear word at the time. You know, I mean, by today's standards, the word bastard is just like saying, you know, the word the. But, you know, it's just like, you know, it's nothing. But back in the early 80s, saying bastard was, you know, you get your mouth washed out with soap for saying it. And then at the very end, when it said, you're not going to fuck with me, I mean, you just like cringed, you know, if there was a parent in the room when that line came on, because you were afraid that they were going to hear it. And like I said, by today's standards, it's really, you know, kids are probably laughing at this interview we're doing right now going, you know, what, are you kidding me? You know, when you can say the F word walking down the street. But, you know, back then it was to have that word printed on, first of all, in print, and then it being in the song, kind of had to play it in secrecy in some places, you know, by those standards. But I thought it was a really bold move. And again, it just kind of made me more intrigued by the band and want to find out more about them. I mean, Nikki Sixx is a mastermind for the way he went about it, because he knew what would get people interested. He knew what would get kids interested in it and things like that. And he knew what would get people talking.
Yeah, and I mean, lyrically, things have taken a dark turn, as this is essentially like a revenge fantasy about killing a rapist. So while you can argue that, you know, we've been talking about the satanic aspects of the album, whether that's misinterpreted or not, there's very much an anger and a darkness to Bastard that is very different in tone to the rest of the album.
I mean, my theory, I guess you could say, is, you know, you had the four elements of Motley Crue. You know, Mick Mars just wanted to play guitar, just wanted to be the best guitar player he could and make the best music he could. You know, Vince Neil was more kind of in it for the party aspect, you know, meeting girls and partying and making money and being a rock star. Tommy Lee was just kind of all over the place. You know, he was just really excited. He was a kid. He just, you know, all this fame and fortune. He got to play drums and this and that. He was kind of just going along with it. But Nikki Sixx was the deep thinker. And I think, you know, with him having such a lot of demons of his childhood and dark past and things, I think he really dove into a lot of that on the earlier records, you know, before his heroin addiction really kicked in, and when he was dealing with a lot of the demons of the past and being young and things that had happened to him in recent years before Motley Crue had formed. I think a lot of that stuff comes from his dark past and dark childhood and things that he was like really angry about, or things that he was just rebelling against society and everything about it at that point.
So Bastard and the other songs in the Filthy 15 were a driving force of the PMRC getting record companies to put parental advisory stickers on album covers for the first time. Ironically, what the PMRC didn't realise was that this would just incite kids to want to buy these albums even more. And sales of Shout of the Devil at this point skyrocketed. Looking back, Vince Neil said of the whole situation, once he put that sticker on, that parental warning sticker, that album took off. Those kids wanted it even more. So in a messed up way, we have Bastard, which is an album track, it wasn't a single, and Al Gore's wife to thank for part of the success of this album.
Yeah, I mean, it totally backfired on him, and it was probably about the stupidest move you could make, because they did it really half-assed as far as, you know, the stickering, because all it said was parental advisory. You didn't have to have a parent with you to buy it. You didn't have to be 18 or over to buy it. It just was a warning. So any kid could still walk in the record store and buy the record, and it wasn't enforced. So seeing that sticker as a kid, it's like, oh, there's got to be something in here that I'm not supposed to see. So of course you're going to want to see it. It's like when people used to rent video cassettes and movies, and there'd be like video stores, it'd be like sneaking into the back curtain at the porn section, looking at the boxes, you know, what's behind that curtain? Well, what's in this record that they're putting a sticker on it? And it completely backfired on the whole thing. I mean, they either needed to not do it at all, or they needed to do it to where it was like enforced even more, but they conceded on a sticker, which did nothing but sell more records. So yeah, we probably do have the PMRC to thank for that one. So
so we'll move on to one of my favorite parts of the album and another album highlight for Mick Mars, which is God Bless the Children of the Beast. So obviously this is an instrumental leading in to our next track, Helter Skelter, and it's kind of a mix of acoustic and electric guitar. Classic Rock Review note influences ranging from Steve Hackett to Randy Rhoads. Do you hear those kind of influences on a track like this one? Or do you think that Mick Mars, we've talked about how underrated he is, do you think maybe this is just kind of him doing his own thing?
Yeah, I think it definitely plays to classical type overtones in it. But it that song is so important to the record, even though it's really not a song. It's more of an interlude. But I just think same with like God Bless the Children of the Beast and In the Beginning are just such important pieces to that record because it sets the tone. It really just absorbed you more into the record and more into the like the it was the record to me is kind of almost like watching a horror film. It's got all these peaks and valleys and it gives you chills and it's kind of like eerie at times. And then it's kind of like lighthearted a little bit at times, but it's really got this nice, real dark kind of like horror film type esque vibe to it. And I think that like those two pieces that I just said were so perfect and so necessary for that record to have the feeling and continuity that it had. And the guitar work on it is great. And, you know, at the end when they say, you know, God bless the children of the beast, she just really got the spine tingling right there, you know?
So, I mean, it reminds me, and this might be just me, and you might completely disagree. It reminds me of a song that actually came out a year later, and I'm not claiming that anyone's kind of copied anywhere or anything like that, but God Bless the Children of the Beast, it almost has the same vibe as the beginning of something like Fade to Black by Metallica, which would obviously be released the following year on Ride the Lightning. Do you get where I'm coming from here, or do you think that's maybe just me?
Yeah, I do, and as a fan of a really big fan of early Metallica, you know, I wouldn't say they necessarily maybe stole it, but they probably did hear it and thought that it would be something cool to nod to. And again, you know, Ride the Lightning with the pieces that they put in there, that really adds to the vibe and the feel of the Metallica record too. I love little interludes and little musical things that aren't necessarily songs on records. I think those make a record into a body of work. You know, if you're going to listen to the record from start to finish, it really adds to the whole feeling and the experience of the album.
So during my research for our chat, I found a pretty extreme reaction to God Bless the Children of the Beast. So it's from a book, and the title will already give you an idea what this is going to be like. The book was called The Moral Decay of Society, America Under Attack.
Oh, wow.
And it goes through, part of the book goes through the entire album that the author, Eugene T. Motes, appears to have been a fan of as a kid, but however, as an adult, he feels very differently about it. And this is what he said. He said, "Yes, this track is only an instrumental, but it is just as deadly. This instrumental is diabolical and evil. You can't imagine the thoughts I had when blasting this crap in my ears continuously. I did feel like a child of the beast, bracket Satan, instead of a child of God." Which is a very, very strong reaction to an instrumental. But I guess when we're talking about it building a mood and creating a vibe for the album, you know, perhaps to just call it an instrumental is maybe underrated because it obviously meant a lot to him as a fan and he has a very strong reaction to it now as an adult.
Yeah, I mean, but kind of hearing that just kind of makes me think that he's going a tad bit overboard on that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, when I look at it, it's kind of like watching a scary movie. You know, if you watch a movie that's about somebody being possessed or you watch a horror movie where they're chopping people up into little bitty pieces, it's not promoting you to go become a mass murderer or to go start a seance or anything. It's entertainment, you know, and that's what it's meant for. It's meant to provoke an emotion. And it's like watching a horror movie or watching a comedy. It's supposed to make you laugh. It's not supposed to make you go do these things, you know, kill people and stuff. And, you know, if you really look at it and our entire culture and society, there's so many movies about, you know, even if you just take a horror film, for instance, you know, and you watch a Friday the 13th, there's nobody that goes and mimics, you know, Jason Voorhees and puts on a hockey mask and goes and chops up people and goes on a killing spree. Out of all the billions of people on the planet, nobody's ever done anything like that. So I people like that that just take it and run with it to the absolute extremes, I think is taking it a little bit too far, if you ask me.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll move on to Helter Skelter. Now, even the fact that Helter Skelter is on this album is controversial enough, and I think it's an absolute masterstroke. It's a cover of the Beatles song from the White Album, released in 1968, and the reason for anyone who doesn't know that it's a controversial choice is as a result of the song's association with cult leader Charles Manson. And again, I think that's a very intentional move by the band. Before we get into the song, what do you think of that act of covering Helter Skelter? Do you agree with me that it's a masterstroke for the album at this point?
I mean, when I first heard it, I didn't know that it was a cover song because I had never listened to the Beatles when I was a kid. So I thought it was kind of like a sore thumb of the record just because it didn't kind of match up with the other songs on the record. But when I learned it was a cover, it made sense. And I remember being in a music store and they released a Helter Skelter picture disc and it had a refrigerator with bloody hands on it and Helter Skelter written in blood. It had Helter Skelter. It had, I think, Too Young to Fall in Love, and it had two Leather Records mixes of Too Fast for Love songs on there. And I just remember I bought it, and it was just, it did add to the eeriness of it. It kind of added to the whole part of, oh my gosh, you know, this Shot at the Devil record is really something to be reckoned with. I think it was a perfect choice. Although at the time I didn't really quite understand the song because I didn't know it was a cover. And then once I found out that it was, it made total sense to me, but I thought it was a really cool rendition.
So just to give some context for those who are unaware, and obviously the Beatles didn't have any of this in mind when they wrote the song, but Charles Manson believed that several songs from the White Album, but particularly Helter Skelter, were attempts by the band to prophesize an apocalyptic war building as a result of racial tensions between black and white people at that time. And he called that scenario the Helter Skelter scenario. Now, as we're talking now, all of that was over 50 years ago. The original version of Helter Skelter was released in 1968. But in 1983, Charles Manson was still comparatively fresh in the public consciousness, thereby making any association with the song controversial. And I guess that's why they possibly chose to have it included on the album.
Oh, yeah. And the picture disc just said it all. When you have the bloody refrigerator, the bloody hands, and it said Helter Skelter on there and the Motley Crue logo. That was a bold move. Nowadays, if you put something like that out, like, let's just say there's a shooting somewhere and you put out a picture disc with like a picture of it and people falling out of a window or something. I mean, it would be banned everywhere. People would flip out about it. I mean, back then, that was a really bold statement. In fact, I'm surprised that they actually got away with something like that back then. I mean, nowadays people are even more sensitive. So I don't even know how something like that would even be perceived, but, it was something. In fact, I'm looking at the picture disc right now. You made me pull it out while we're on the phone here.
Awesome. Awesome.
It's pretty brutal. Even for today's standards, it's pretty brutal.
Yeah. I'm going to have a look for it. I'm going to have to see if I can find it.
Yeah, I'm sure you can see if you Google it. Just Google Motley Crue Helter Skelter picture disc. And it came with this gigantic 8-foot poster. And, you know, the picture disc had them in the Shout of the Devil Blood sessions. And then there's a insert on there that has a bloody refrigerator. It's crazy. Definitely worth a Google.
Yeah, yeah. So if we put aside the Charles Manson stuff, many people cite the original Beatles version of Helter Skelter as a key part of the early development of heavy metal. So it makes total sense that Motley Crue would choose to cover it from that perspective. Metal Injection ranked the original Beatles version in its 10 heaviest songs released before metal was a thing. So as someone who's made a career in heavy metal yourself, would you agree with Helter Skelter's importance in the development of the genre?
I mean, I would probably say, you know, bands like, you know, the Beatles and even Elvis Presley to some degree, you know, influenced the bands of today because they influenced their influences and so on and so forth. I mean, I think that bands like that were really ahead of their time. And I mean, Sabbath naturally is what I consider the godfathers of heavy metal, where, you know, they were cutting parts of the speaker out because they didn't have full distortion pedals and they wanted to get a heavier sound. So they were actually modifying their own amps to get some sort of a distortion out of it. But, you know, if it wasn't for bands like that and stuff like that, there wouldn't be the bands of today. For their genre, they were heavy, you know, and people were freaking out because they had what they called long hair, which by today's standards, it's nothing. But, you know, back then it was really something.
So we'll move on to side two. Obviously, we're talking vinyl and cassettes, and we open side two with Red Hot. So Sputnik Music call Red Hot a classic heavy metal song driven by Lee's drums. It's fast, short, and great. Now, we've talked a lot on My Classic Album about albums that were released in the days of vinyl and cassettes, having to grab the listener at the start of side two because you've got that physical act of turning the album over. Does Red Hot do a good job of reeling you back in for side two?
Oh, absolutely. I love Red Hot. That's one of my favorite records on the album, actually. I mean, it's just, and back even again in those standards and everything, that was a fast song. That was some really impressive drumming for the time, and still one of my favorite songs on the record. I love that song. Perfect opener for side two.
So obviously we've talked a bit about the drumming. Tommy Lee's drumming on Red Hot is particularly strong, and I feel like at this point, you know, he's such a pop culture icon in some ways. We know more about his personal life than we maybe want to, but do you think that he's perhaps underrated as a drummer as a result due to him having such this larger-than-life personality and everyone knows who Tommy Lee is, even if they're not necessarily familiar with Motley Crue's music?
I mean, I think that Tommy Lee's definitely got all the notoriety he deserves and more. I mean, people still rave about his drumming and how he's one of the top drummers. And I mean, he literally has accomplished so much for the drumming community. I mean, he literally brought a drummer out to being like the forefront of a concert with going upside down, going sideways, going in the air with a roller coaster, all this other stuff. He's done more for showmanship and attention of drummers than I think probably hands down almost anybody else out there. He's just taken it to such extremes. And then when you go in with his personal life, and you know, a lot of that's probably perpetuated by, you know, Heather Locklear and Pam Anderson and the controversy and stuff surrounding that. I really think he's done an amazing job for himself. And I definitely think that he's definitely got the attention he deserved and a lot more than that. You know, Mick Mars is definitely the only underrated person in the band for sure.
So we've talked a little about the influences on this album earlier on, and I mentioned that I felt that parts of the album tip the hat to other bands that were around at the time, like Iron Maiden. And I feel that the guitar work on Red Hot really has a Maiden-esque feel to it at certain parts. It's that kind of dual guitars in the solo, I think, are very Maiden. But again, it's testament to Mick Mars that he can give a track such a heavy punch.
I mean, you know, Maiden's so damn good, and they're such an amazing band, and their musicianship is just like, it jaw-dropping at times. I've never really pictured Motley Crue as like, when you listen to their music, that it's technically jaw-dropping. I've always thought of them as having like really cool riffs and Mick Mars doing some really innovative and cool guitar solos. I've never really categorized them as like something that you could throw in as like a technical Iron Maiden type thing. But I do see what you're saying, where, you know, there's elements of like some of the little gallops and things like that in there that tip a hat to it for sure.
So we'll move on to Too Young to Fall in Love. I'm returning to Sputnik Music for this one because they have really high praise for Too Young to Fall in Love. They said it has a damned riff, which I just can't describe without getting excited. It's arguably the most complex one of the album, and clearly the best. And the chorus is outstanding, as well as sticky. Is this one as good as that review says it is?
I love that song as well. And again, if you go back to the era that it came out in, that's when MTV was just really gaining popularity. And the video for that is so brilliant. I mean, they basically made a martial arts kung fu movie into a video for that. And it was just so cutting edge at the time and so dynamic at the time. I mean, you can even watch that video now and it withstands the test of time. So I think that blended with just how great the song was, just made that one like a really standout, just amazing badass song for the record. I love that song. It's one that I even go back and just listen to on its own nowadays without even listening to the full record.
I mean, Too Young to Fall in Love was actually released as a single, but it stalled at number 90 on the Billboard Hot 100. And as a result, it hasn't made it into many of the compilation albums that the band have released over the years. Do you think that perhaps because it was less controversial than other tracks on the album, perhaps people were talking about it less, it maybe got lost in the shuffle? And I guess it sounds like you would think that's a bit of a disservice to it because it's such a great track.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a fantastic track. But, you know, with anything, you know, that song, I really think, served its purpose. As far as a video, it didn't translate over the airwaves like a song like Looks That Kill did or anything like that. For whatever reason it does, it's just, you know, sometimes that stuff just kind of happens for no real reason. But I think what that song did is it really solidified Motley Crue as a mainstay on like MTV and with music videos and stuff. So I think that song really deserves its due credit for the fact that it might not have been a huge radio hit. It was definitely a monumental and groundbreaking video that really set the bar and set the standards for the MTV generation.
So we'll move on to Knock 'Em Dead Kid. Ultimate Classic Rock ranked Knock 'Em Dead Kid 12th in its top 50 Motley Crue songs in 2017. And they said about the track, Shout With The Devil was such a deep LP that a song as irresistible as Knock 'Em Dead Kid could somehow get lost in the shuffle. Yet on any other album, this swaggering tough guy anthem would probably be a lead single. Would you agree with this one? Could this have been a bigger song? Could this have been a lead single or maybe even another Motley Crue album?
I mean, that song is definitely an anthem. I mean, hands down. And in fact, if you look in the liner notes, they dedicated it to the LA Police Department, who weren't on the top of their list of their favorite people at the time, because I think they were getting arrested left and right when they were causing trouble. The only reason I could see that not being a single is just because of the lyrical content. It was a bit, you know, harsh for the time that it came out. That one's definitely more of a deep cut to me than it is, you know, single worthy, but it's definitely an important track. And again, makes the album that much more enjoyable to listen to front to back.
Knock of Dead Kid, it's another song with a really interesting history. So in the Cruise tell-all biography, The Dirt, Nicky claims, as you were kind of talking about with the LA Police Department, Nicky claims he once hit an undercover cop with a chain who proceeded to retaliate and break his cheekbone. And that was the incident that inspired him to write the song. However, it is one of the songs that a gentleman called Matthew Fripp claims that he actually wrote. And now Matthew infamously claimed that for several years he was asked to impersonate Nicky Six, while the real Nicky recovered from a car accident. Have you heard about this before? Because the whole thing is ridiculously fascinating when you read into it.
Yeah, I mean, that was a big thing back, you know, when at the time when he was claiming that. And they debunked him pretty well back then. I personally think it was just, you know, a kid trying to get attention, somebody trying to stir the pot. You know, maybe he was a little off balance or whatever, but it was definitely newsworthy at the time, and a lot of people were talking about it. But there was, we're going pretty far back for my memory, but I remember there was something that this kid said that just didn't quite add up as far as his story, and it was pretty quickly debunked. And, you know, everybody just kind of looked at the kid as kind of like a lunatic at the time, so they just kind of pushed him off. I mean, the theory of it is kind of cool. You know, because Nicky did get in that accident with the Porsche and stuff like that. But if you look at it, you know, Nicky just had, you know, had a pin put in his shoulder and, you know, recovered from it and stuff like that. The real question that I always have is, because Nicky broke his shoulder during the Shout the Devil sessions before he recorded, I've always wondered whether it's Nicky or Mick Mars playing bass on that record, because Nicky had broken his shoulder. And I don't know if he was able to quite play at that time. That's one that I'd really love to, I don't think anybody will ever admit it or tell the real story on it, but that's one that it's always pondered and gotten me curious over the years.
Yeah, yeah. I, to be honest, like, obviously I knew that he'd had that injury, but that's never a connection I'd made, so that's really interesting.
Comes with being a Motley Crue fanatic.
So we'll move on to 10 Seconds to Love. So 10 Seconds to Love is the one song on the album where Nicky shares the songwriting credit with Vince Neil. Do you think that that gives the song a different flavor to the rest of the album? Can you hear Vince's contributions from a songwriting perspective on a song like 10 Seconds to Love?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Vince Neil, you know, he self-proclaimed. He was in it for the booze and the chicks and to be a rock star. They had a tablature book for guitar out for that. And I remember, like, each song's kind of like dissected, and the band member, you know, an individual band member talks about the song or whatever in the, like, little notes of the tablature book. And I remember Nicky was saying, this song's the cock and balls song, you know, which is just, it's basically just about banging a chick and taking a picture of her and, you know, yada, yada. And it's just a complete sex song, you know, and you can really hear, you can kind of hear Vince's influence on there, because, you know, that's what he was into, is just having a good time and banging chicks. And you can definitely hear his contribution lyrically to it for sure.
So Sputnik Music actually highlight 10 Seconds to Love as having the best bass line on the whole album, which is quite ironic with what we were just talking about a couple of minutes ago. Yeah. We've talked so much about Nicky, the songwriter and the mastermind of Motley Crue and this, that, and the other. As a bass player yourself, how influential is Nicky Six as a bass player to you and your development as a musician?
You know, I'm actually happy you asked that, because it's something that, you know, I kind of have two perspectives on it. Like, as far as, like, image, like, Nicky Six, I would say if I had to pick a rock and roll hero, I'd definitely pick Nicky Six. You know, I probably stole so many stage moves off of him. I probably owe him a few hundred grand at this point, just for the just for the fact that I've emulated him quite a bit over the years, you know, and I definitely can, you know, definitely admit that. But, you know, the thing I really admired is I love his business sense. I love his out of the box thinking. I love his passion for what he does. And, you know, Nicky to me isn't the greatest bass player, but what I like about him is that he keeps it in the pocket and he holds his own. He never claims to be the baddest one, or he never shows off on the bass. And the bass is, for him, it's just more of an extension of his personality and his other creative processes that far exceed his his playing capabilities. But I've always just loved the way he just kind of keeps it in the pocket, keeps it simple, and, you know, maintains a good undertone for it. And then, you know, Mick Mars comes out and does his stuff and shines a little bit with the rhythms and the solos and stuff. It's just a really good combo. I think he really harnessed his place in Motley Crue as what the bass should be doing and what it shouldn't be doing. And, you know, Motley Crue to me, it's all about the vibe of the entire song and what's best for the entire song. There's really no showing off in Motley Crue, but it all works together in just some sort of fabulous way. It's probably the best way I can put it.
And I think it's really, that we've talked about that's really cool, because I think that really applies to our final track on the album, which is Danger. Certainly a change of pace from the rest of Shout of the Devil. It might actually be my favourite song on the album. What are your thoughts on Danger? And does it feel like a change in pace compared to all the other songs that came before it?
It's funny you say that, because I have to 100% agree with you. That could quite possibly be one of the songs I've listened to the most on that record, because it's just, there's just some really cool vibe about it. And again, you know, with me taking, you know, some Motley Crue things and applying them to, you know, my own music and band, is in Soil, we've always put, at the end of any Soil record, the last song is always like a sore thumb. It's always like some sort of song that just kind of has a place of its own and kind of outros the record. And I was always pushing for that because of, you know, Motley Crue would always do that. And most notably on the Shout of the Devil record, it's just a perfect outro to kind of end all the chaos and everything that's going on with the Shout at the Devil record. It just is a nice end chapter book closer to that album.
Classic Rock Review called Danger the finest pure song on the album. They say, melodramatic but beautiful, the song contains a variety of guitar textures by Mars, along with passionate and wailing vocals by Neil, and great drum fills by Lee, making it a very complete band effort and a showcase for their talent at the time. Now, I think Motley Crue often get a hard time from people who think that they aren't the most talented band in the world. But I surely think that a track like Danger is the evidence that you would need to refute that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's so many really cool peaks and valleys on that song, especially like vocally. Yeah, it's just like a perfect album closer, in my opinion.
So it seems strange to think that an album with so much controversy and audacity, I guess, would end on what's in some ways is a ballad. But it really works, and it's arguably Vince Neil's finest moment on the album. We've talked about kind of its ups and downs vocally. I feel like we've taken a moment to highlight everyone but Vince so far. How important is Vince's very unique, distinguishable vocal in the Motley Crue sound?
Oh, I mean, it's the whole thing. I mean, be it as it may, people sit there, some people rave and say that Vince is an amazing vocalist. Other people say that he's not a great vocalist. In my opinion, he is like the perfect vocalist for Motley Crue, and he adds to the sound just as much as Mickey's songwriting or Mick's guitar playing or Tommy's, you know, amazing drum thing. I mean, you hear Vince Neil, you know it's Vince Neil. I mean, he has such an iconic voice that it's almost impossible to mimic. It's kind of like an Ozzy Osbourne. When you hear Ozzy, you know it's Ozzy. He's such an iconic front man, and he has such a distinguishable voice. That's part of what made Motley Crue Motley Crue and why they were one of the greatest bands or biggest bands of all time. And a lot of that has to do with Vince's unique voice. Nobody sounded like that. Nobody still sounds like that. But, you know, especially then, nobody sounded like he did. And he definitely had all the moves to back it up with, too.
So how does Danger finish the album for you?
I think if I could go back and pick a track listing for the record, I wouldn't change a thing. And that's why it's remained my favorite record for decades. It's just such a perfect record from start to finish. It starts off in this crazy mood and it ends beautifully. Like, it ends in like a beautiful tragedy to me. I don't like listening to it out of context. Like, I don't like putting it on shuffle. When I listen to that record, I need to listen to it from in the beginning to Danger and just in that order, because it just takes you through so many peaks and valleys and tells a story. It's a perfect record to me.
It's an album that's remembered for the uproar it caused as much as the great music contained within it. And it might just be the reason that we now have parental advisory stickers on albums, but it's really the sound of a band that were ready to take the mantle of biggest band in the world. And I'm going to leave the last word to Satchel from Steel Panther, who said the following to Classic Rock magazine in 2009. And I picked it because the first time I saw Steel Panther, they actually covered Shout of the Devil and did a really good job of it. So Satchel said, without this album, a lot of the great hair metal bands wouldn't have come about. Theatre of Pain was more of their glam look, but Shout with the Devil was such a great record. It was fucking sick. They set the bar. People looked at that and said, fuck, we gotta dress up cool, man. With that in mind, why does Shout with the Devil stand the test of time for you?
I think he summed it up perfectly. Even to this day, you look at that record and it's still, it's not cheesy whatsoever. You look at that record and it's still cool. It's like a black leather jacket. It just never goes out of style. I think that's the best summing up of that record.
And finally, why is Shout with the Devil your classic album, and why should people check it out if they haven't already?
It's my classic record because it's basically what got me into heavy metal. It got me into Motley Crue. Motley Crue's been my favorite band since I've been 11 years old, and I'm ancient now. And it's definitely worth a listen. Even to the kids of today, it's an important record in the fact that Black Veil Brides and Asking Alexandria and all that, you know, stemmed from that. I mean, Black Veil Brides even admits that they stem from it. So these new bands coming out that are taking over the scene and very popular and stuff were influenced by this record. In fact, Black Veil Brides, probably the closest band that I've seen like emulate Motley Crue as far as, you know, that Shout at the Devil era stuff. And I actually really like that band too. So, I mean, it's great to see how that record's withstood the test of time and influenced newer and popular bands of today.
Well, Tim, thank you so much for joining me to talk Shout at the Devil. It's been absolutely awesome.
I got to tell you, I've done thousands of interviews over the course of my career, and this is definitely in the top five of my favorite ones. It was just really interesting and different and really cool to talk about that. So thanks a lot, man.
Well, that was awesome. Thanks to Tim King for joining me on My Classic Album to chat about his chosen album, Shout with the Devil by Motley Crue. And if that's got you wanting more Motley Crue, don't forget that The Dirt is on Netflix now, the movie adaptation of their best-selling autobiography, which is the good, the bad, and the ugly of the career of Motley Crue. The book is highly recommended if you haven't read it already. Obviously, there's been mixed reviews for the film. I would just say check it out. I enjoyed it. And between watching that and chatting with Tim, it has got me listening to Motley Crue for the first time in a long time. And I guess that's what the band want. They've got a soundtrack out as well, which has got all the hits and a couple of new songs. So if you're new to Motley Crue and this episode and the film has piqued your interest, now is the perfect time to get into Motley Crue because love and interest in them is higher than ever. As for Soil, they will be touring Europe towards the back end of the year, including a massive UK tour. They're touring with Static X, Wednesday 13, and Dope to celebrate the 20th anniversary of Static X's classic album, Wisconsin Death Trip, and a tribute to their fallen lead singer, Wayne Static. So you can find all the details at soiltheband.com for more information about that tour, and I'll post it on our social media pages as well. I'm hoping to get to the Newcastle date of the tour, so if you are coming along to that and you see me, come say hi. Sadly, that's it for another episode of My Classic Album. As I said earlier, a massive change in pace. In a couple of weeks' time, we're going to be looking at Aretha Franklin's I Never Loved a Man the Way That I Love You. And my special guest will be Nell Bryden, singer-songwriter extraordinaire. And yeah, it's another great episode, so I really hope that you guys tune in and enjoy it. Don't forget to keep yourself on the social media pages. Make sure you subscribe on Apple Music or wherever you listen to your podcasts to make sure that you don't miss an episode. And yeah, just keep listening. Thank you very much. It's really exciting at the minute because more and more people are discovering the podcast, more and more people are listening to it, and I couldn't be happier. So thank you very much, and I will see you in a couple of weeks for my chat with Nell about all things Aretha. Cheers.